Our state's corn growers are facing a tough planting season with the rain not letting up. We're talking about it on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some farmers aren't able to get into their fields, and that's stressful. Doug Rebout is president of the Wisconsin Corn Growers Association.
They've been getting loans and eating up equity on their farms. So if the farmer doesn't get their crop in or they have low yields because it's getting it in late, that's going to be a big impact for farms.
Are you a farmer who hasn't planted yet? How is that affecting your business? We're at 800-642-1234. Hope Kerwin is WPR's reporter in La Crosse, and she joins us from our studios in La Crosse. Hope, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Can you help us get a better picture of what the state's farm fields are looking like right now?
Yeah, so the latest crop progress report that came out from the state came out yesterday. About 58% of the state's corn acres have been planted at this point, and that's about 17 days behind the five-year average. Soybeans are not much better. They're up at 34% planted at this point in the year, and that's 15 days behind the five-year average.
So how many, as you look at these progress reports, how behind are the state farmers and how is that impacting their business?
Yeah, so I mean, 17 days, 15 days, I mean, that's more than 2 weeks. That's significantly behind the growing season. And, you know, I talked to one agriculture agent from the University of Wisconsin Extension. You know, he said they are losing, you know, a few percentage points of yield potential every day that goes by that they are not able to get seed in the ground. Just the later they plant, the shorter their growing season. And so it's going to have a huge impact on yield potential and just on kind of this year's crop.
And if the state ultimately produces lower yields, how could that affect corn prices or farmers who rely on corn, like dairy farms?
Yeah, so having a smaller crop, you know, it's not just the farmers in Wisconsin that are suffering from wet weather. You know, we're seeing these problems across the Midwest. Actually, Illinois is even farther behind Wisconsin. And so, you know, this is likely to be something that impacts the entire U.S. And so that could actually help raise corn and soybean prices from where they are if people aren't able to plant as much this year or have lower yields because of late planting. But as you mentioned, you know, there are other people in the agriculture industry that rely on corn, like dairy farmers, for feed for their livestock. And so, I mean, because dairy farmers have already seen low milk prices for, you know, going on 5 years now, I mean, they can't afford to pay more for corn.
And certainly corn prices could be a burden on dairy farmers struggling under the low milk prices if we see corn prices go up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they have just really been hit hard. I mean, we've been hearing a lot about the numbers of dairy farms that are closing or selling off livestock across the state. And so, I mean, they're just in dire financial position and they really can't afford to pay higher feed prices.
We're talking with Hope Kerwin. She is WPR's reporter in La Crosse. We're talking about how the wet weather has set back farmers getting into their fields to plant. And Hope, Friday marked the deadline for federal crop insurance. What happens now if farmers want to take the insurance?
Yeah, so that Friday deadline was for, you know, corn for grain in the state. Soybean dates are coming up here pretty soon as well. And so what that basically means is, you know, farmers have a couple of options. They can either plant their crop late past that deadline, but, you know, take lower insurance coverage on their crop and kind of, you know, risk something happening later in the season and not being able to see as you know, much return on because of their insurance coverage being lowered, or they can potentially take a payout from their insurance. It's called prevented planting. But the problem with that is a lot of farmers are looking at the new tariff relief aid that's been recently announced by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They haven't quite announced what that's going to look like for each farmer, but the little that people do know about it is it looks like people are going to have to plant this year to be able to seed some of that tariff relief aid. So, you know, I was talking with that UW Extension ag agent, you know, and he said, unfortunately, they just don't have a lot of good information to give farmers to help them make that decision.
You talked earlier about prevented planting. What is that?
Yeah, so prevented planting is for situations just like this, where weather does not allow farmers to get a crop in the ground. And so if they're prevented from planting by a certain, day in the calendar year, that just either allows them to take a 55%, I believe, payout on their insurance, depending on what their coverage levels. I mean, if this is highly individualized, like all insurance is, or they can take reduced insurance coverage and risk planting.
So how much money can farmers get from insurance?
It's highly individualized. It just depends on what coverage levels they have, what their yield potential looks like, and, what price they're calculating on. So, that's something that's decided on a farm-by-farm basis.
Are they better off planting but getting lower yields? I mean, is that something they have to calculate?
That is the million-dollar question at this point. And, that's kind of what I was talking about, is they're left with this, question that they kind of have to decide. Do they plant and potentially plant and have, a crop this year and see corn prices rise and see potential there? Or do they take, the guaranteed prevented planting payment from their insurance, program, it's kind of a tough decision that each farmer is facing who hasn't been able to get, seed in the ground.
Could President Trump's tariffs impact the crop insurance program in any way?
Well, I think the tariffs have definitely had a huge impact on farmers in that, it's continuing to hurt demand for their product. And so, in a situation where, the last few years we've seen a lot of, corn in storage at the end of the year or soybeans in storage at the end of the year because, we've just had really, high producing a couple of years. It's really hurting farmers in that sense, that they're seeing lower prices. And so the thing that's really going to impact these planting decisions is, like I said, that tariff relief aid, what's called the market facilitation program. We just don't know a lot about what those payments are going to look like or, how those will be calculated. And so, it's kind of leaving a lot of indecision among farmers.
Hope, you talk to farmers all the time. Is this year unusual? Is it worse this year with the wet weather and getting corn in and soybean?
Yeah, I mean, I recently saw an article that was released by the American Farm Bureau Federation. They're a major agriculture group. They are calling this a historically delayed corn planting. This is highly significant that we are so behind in the planting season. And so, this is just really unprecedented. I spoke with the president of the Corn Growers Association, and he said that he had never seen this in all of his years of farming. So this is really a tough situation that a lot of farmers have not seen before. Of course, there's always wet springs. There's always planting later than farmers would like. But to see into early June, this is really significant.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hope Kerwin is WPR's reporter in La Crosse, and she joined us from our studios there. We've been talking about how farmers are facing a late planting season and what effects those delays have on crops and the farm business. Up next, a diverse group of entrepreneurs and startups will be competing this week in the Governor's Business Plan Contest. We'll hear about how our state is becoming more friendly for entrepreneurs as the annual conference gets underway today in Milwaukee. That's in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about startups in Wisconsin on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The 17th Annual Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Conference attracts up-and-coming businesses from a variety of industries, IT, advanced manufacturing, life sciences. People involved in young companies learn how to fund their businesses, they figure out legal issues, they market their products and connect with startups who were once in their shoes. As an entrepreneur, do you feel supported here in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tom Still is president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, which is hosting the Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Conference in Milwaukee today and tomorrow. Tom, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you, Kate. Glad to be back.
So tell us what this event is about and what's going on there in Milwaukee.
Sure. We are hosting, as you said, the 17th Annual Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Conference. It is a conference that is designed really for companies that are in some kind of early stage, but often those that are moving beyond. We have three tracks that kind of reflect that. There's a launch track for the earliest, a grow track for those that are kind of in a middle stage, and succeed track for those that may be well down the line. This is where the Wisconsin Governor's Business Plan Contest culminates. And so we'll have 13 of the top plans out of a process that began in late January. They'll present, and there'll be awards around that. This is where we award our Seize the Day award, which is to essentially our Entrepreneur of the Year. And this year it's Sue Marks, who did a number of startups over time, and now runs a company called Cielo, which is still based in Wisconsin, and it does human resources work throughout the world. So it's a little bit of everything for people.
Well, getting back to the Wisconsin Governor's Business Plan Contest, which is a big part of the event, what is the goal there? What do you get out of it?
The goal is really to help young companies get up and on their feet and, you know, start to walk before they have to run. And provide exposure to them as they move along. We have a group of about 100 volunteer judges who examine these plans as they come in. And again, the process starts in late January. It goes through phases in which they write business plans that really check the box in a lot of categories. We have mentors that can help them if they have questions, especially around the finance side or the legal side or whatever it may be. And then the goal is that it really does boil down to today we have 13 who are going to present, and it is to hear from them, hear their plans, and they're judged once again on a live stage. And it's all about creating new companies, because over time, a lot of companies that have come through this contest have done very well. So it really all adds to Wisconsin's economy.
And I understand they are a real mix of entries, a real diverse group in the contest.
They really are. And some of that's by design, because there are four categories for the contest. Advanced manufacturing, business services, information technology, and life sciences. And so what happens today is that the top group in each of those categories will present. The plans can range from a do-it-yourself airplane kit to a better way to dispose of hypodermic needles to ways for daycares to better monitor and record activities of children. So it's really all over the map.
Talking with Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, and we're looking at what's happening at the Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Conference in Milwaukee today and tomorrow. You can join in, 800-642-1234. As an entrepreneur, do you feel supported in Wisconsin? How do you think the state can build the best possible entrepreneurial culture? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Tom, can you tell us about a few of the pitches in this year's Diligent Dozen, also known as the finalists in the Governor's Business Plan Contest, and what's in it for the winner?
Sure. The winner will win a variety of cash and prizes, and they can be, you know, what we call service prizes. So in other words, it can be things like legal services, accounting services, office space, you know, a mix of things that all, you know, young companies can find valuable. And it's really that kind of thing that they get out of it. But what they tell us, and it told us over time, is that the number one thing they get out of it is just the ability to go through the contest, to take a plan that had been on their desk or in the back of their mind and develop it and grow it up to, you know, where it needed to be.
So this is really about refining.
Yes, actually, it truly is, and especially refining over a period of time. The contest is designed because we start with just 250 words. It's really an abstract, and they can build on that from there. So some contests in some places, they might start by, you know, right out of the box. Let's have a 15-page or a 20-page plan. Well, that's tough for people to do if when they're really just kind of walking through the process. So we deliberately make it starting with 250 words, then 1,000 words, then a full plan, and then at that point we have the best of those present live to our judges.
What do you think still needs to be done by our state to improve support around startups? How can we better diversify our startup base here in Wisconsin?
I think there's a number of things. Let me start by telling you a little bit about what I think has been done over time. And some of this will sound like a history lesson, but way back in 2000 through 2003, there were things called the Wisconsin Economic Summits that were held, some of which were in Milwaukee. Out of that came the notion of industry clusters, regionalism within the state because parts of the state are different than others, the notion of the corridor connecting Chicago, Milwaukee, Madison on up. That is alive and well today. In fact, that's the theme of this conference. And the fact that technology was still not where it needed to be in Wisconsin. So out of that came a good infrastructure, the notion that we needed more capital, meaning angel and venture capital, and this notion of regional economies. And in fact, today you see regional economic development groups throughout Wisconsin. The needs today are still, in some areas, capital.
And I want to stop you there, Tom. Angel investors and finding that capital. Do startups have to go out of state to find financing? Is that a problem in Wisconsin?
And in some later stages, that can be helpful for some types of companies. But this is a state that has really a highly developed number of angel networks. In 2004, when we started our organization on that path, there were maybe a half dozen angel networks or funds in Wisconsin. Today, there are close to 40. Now, not all entrepreneurs need angel financing, want angel financing. It's not right for everybody, but that end of the spectrum is pretty vibrant today. In fact, one of our speakers is going to be someone who, over time, looked at 10,000 different pitch decks and made 55 investments and eight exits, meaning the company was somehow sold, acquired, grew up, whatever. So on that end of the capital spectrum, we're in pretty good shape. On the other end, the kinds of later rounds that are in the millions of dollars that are needed, especially by some companies in life sciences, there's a greater need.
At the conference, you're going to be moderating a panel called Connecting the IQ Corridors. What is that?
The IQ Corridor is a name I came up with for that corridor connecting Chicago, Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, on up through the Chippewa Valley and into the Twin Cities. The I stands, of course, for interstate, but ideas, innovation, intellectual property, and investment. And the Q is for quality. And I think one of the things that we have in this region is a quality of research, of education, of talent, of all the kinds of things that can really help put this region more on the map. You know, if you think about California, which is fortunate enough to have it all in one state, their tech hubs, which range from Silicon Valley to San Diego, that's about 500 plus miles. Between Chicago and the Twin Cities is about 400 miles. It just happens to straddle three states. And so that is the notion of this IQ corridor is an upper Midwest cluster that increasingly is drawing a lot of attention around what's going on here.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're so welcome, Kate.
Tom Still is president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, and it's hosting the Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Conference in Milwaukee that gets underway today and runs through tomorrow. Coming up, we learn how musicians make their living with a concert promoter and a hip-hop artist as our guide. Are you a professional musician in Wisconsin or an aspiring artist? We have a line for you to describe how you make ends meet and stay true to your calling. We're at 800-642-1234. That conversation about the business of music is coming up after this news update. Stay with us here in the Ideas Network. Talking about making a living as a musician, it's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Streaming services are set to infuse billions of dollars into the music business, and musicians are once again hoping to get their fair share. Independent artists are really taking the recorded music industry by storm, and that's according to recent reporting by Rolling Stone. It's estimated that last year, self-releasing artists generated $643 million worldwide. So with that as a backdrop, let's zoom in on Wisconsin, where musicians are meeting this week about how to make a living through their craft. Are you a professional musician here in the state? Is it a hobby or your full-time career? What instrument do you play? Where do you perform? And how often are you on the road? Join in with your story at 800-642-1234. Pakal Bailey, who uses the stage name DJ Payne One, is a Madison-based hip-hop artist and record producer. Pakal, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
And we have Marla Frank here as well. She is a CPA and she's chief financial officer for Frank Productions. That's a Madison-based concert promoter. Marla, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, let's start with you. It seems easier than ever for artists to produce music from their home, from their bedroom, release it to the world through the internet. What do musicians need to know about setting up their business to make the most of it?
Well, I think you hit on it previously. The most important thing for any musician to understand is it a hobby or is it a business? And if it is a business, if you have income and if you have expenses that you want to deduct against that income, it's important to set up a business, some type of business format, and play by the rules, because there are very well-defined rules associated with being a business.
What seems to be the trickiest part of the business for young, new musicians to understand?
Basically, the management of the money. If you want to be successful, you have to manage your money, and you cannot manage what you can't measure. So it's the measurement of that money, via accounting records or whatever format, to make sure that you know how to manage your money.
What challenges do you see when you help people deal with it at Frank Productions in your job?
At Frank Productions, my job is not really dealing with artists. I deal with artists in a side project called Yellow Silo Business Management. And working with the musician clients that I work with through Yellow Silo, the biggest challenge is for musicians to understand the scope of their business and how important it is to work with a professional to account for and keep track of their money.
Pakal, in your early years getting off the ground, what challenges did you see in getting your business started?
I think for me, it started, with time management, even before the money management, because I wasn't generating any income. And so imposing a schedule onto myself the same way that there's a schedule in place at a traditional job. You know, people tend to ask musicians, do you have a real job? And that mentality is really damaging for us because we start to believe that music isn't a real job. It's not a legitimate way to generate income for ourselves. And therefore, we don't treat it as such in the sense of creating structure, creating a schedule for ourselves, researching, understanding the business, learning about how to manage our finances, learning about all the various laws that govern our world. And so once I learned that and once I started to impose structure onto myself, that's when I think I made the step from hobbyist to professional, at least at the very beginning stages.
Yeah, but how did you impose that structure? Because, your opportunities and gigs can come and go. They can be at different hours. There can be the flux of it. Like, you get a bunch of work all at once, and then you go through a dry spell. How do you bring structure to that?
I use the term structure loosely, but essentially, you still have to, I still have to wake up every day and there are tasks, daily tasks, that I need to perform in order to keep my business running. For me, and it's a matter of figuring out what you need as an artist and as a business owner, because you're both at the same time. For me, it was social media management. For me, it was understanding and learning about marketing. And then, of course, there are all of the creative elements. So making sure that I'm creating, making sure that I'm networking, making sure that I'm communicating with potential collaborators and potential customers, making sure that my brand identity is strong. Prior to having all of those ducks in a row, it's an absolute mess. And so not having a structured brand just creates unstructured behavior. And I had to really work hard, because creatives, we're notorious for...
Oh, you're not keeping track of receipts, right?
yeah, that's an entirely different conversation. I finally had to get a CPA. I was trying to do it myself, and I didn't know what I was doing at first, but I didn't know what I was doing. And so it wasn't until I hired the CPA that I learned all that I was doing wrong. So I'm happy I did that.
Marla, does that sound a little bit familiar with your clients?
That sounds very familiar. I think a really important thing to understand is the tax laws are like a high-stakes football game. There's a very specific playbook, and you have to play by that book to be successful.
We're talking with Pakal Bailey, who uses the stage name DJ Payne One. He's a Madison-based hip-hop artist and record producer. Marla Frank is a CPA and chief financial officer for Frank Productions, Madison-based concert promoter. Do you work in the music business here in Wisconsin? What's your job and why did you enter the industry? Are you a professional musician? Is it a hobby or your full-time career? And what instruments do you play? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Marla, why is it important for musicians to set up a business structure around themselves? And as Pakal is saying, to give them self-structure. Are there legal issues that artists can run into without that structure?
Very much so. There are legal issues in terms of liability to other people. And also, probably the most important thing is the management of the income and the deductible expenses. One of my favorite sayings is, everyone can be rich. And it's a very, very simple process. You have to manage your money, and you have to spend less than you make. And that's what the financial management is all about, not necessarily to become rich, but to make sure that you have that pool of income, the resources that you need to be able to expand your business.
How difficult are those tax returns to file if you're an independent artist or a traveling musician?
Traveling musicians are probably the most complicated. There are two different formats. You can be a sole proprietor, where all of your income comes to you personally, and those tax returns are a little less complicated. But most musicians, most bands are partnerships, and those are very complicated returns and really do require professional.
Pakal, how did you get started in music?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I was a bored teenager who just wanted to demystify the process, and slowly but surely, I guess I kind of figured it out. As a professional, is that maybe
no, the well, better either question? Way, you were a bored teenager. Yeah. That had led to perhaps led you down a road.
It led me down a lot of roads. yeah, I mean, it wasn't until about 2008 when it became real to me, the possibility of being a career musician. We're not really encouraged to be career artists. You know, it's just something that we do as an outlet when we're frustrated with our legitimate profession, right? So I gave myself a year after I finished my undergraduate degree just to explore whether or not music was a viable career option for me. And somehow within that first 6 month period, I was on a number one album. So that was a sign that I shouldn't just abandon it. And that was only the beginning.
And may I say, this is 2008, about your giving your... Okay, this is the middle of the Great Recession here. I mean, this is a tough time.
Ironically, an album called The Recession, titled The Recession, was my break into the music industry.
Huh. Wow. Who are some of the artists you worked with that our listeners might know?
Oh my gosh, it's a long list. You heard that Mavis Staples and Chuck D songs. I've done a lot of work with Chuck D and Public Enemy, which is my favorite hip-hop group of all time, so that's an amazing nexus. And, you know, 50 Cent, MC Light.
How do you network in order to get these contracts with these musicians and help produce and produce their work?
Every story is vastly different from the other. My very first big song, which was in 2008, which is the reason I'm here right now, was sent to an engineer in Atlanta via a manager in Toronto. And that scenario never played out again.
Hmm. We're talking about how to make a living as a musician. We're looking at all aspects of the industry and where to find good paying gigs to how to pay for taxes in a freelance driven industry. Do you work in the music business? What's your job and why do you go down this career path? We're at 800-642-1234. Concert promoter Marla Frank stays with us, as does hip hop artist Pakal Bailey. And we'll get back to this conversation in a minute here on the Ideas Network.
Your trigger bold and you break my heart. So if you give a damn or you care at all.
Half the industry going bankrupt. You see them smiling in the club with they drinks up. Don't let that television fool you. Off camera they sweating and stressing. My young students, let me school you. Them diamonds ain't worth half what you bought them for. Soon all that Gucci don't fit. Now you out of dough. One day your pockets all right and now they all wrong. You gonna do when it's all gone. Talking about the root of all evil.
We are talking about how to make a living as a musician. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Spotify's founder confirmed recently that nearly 40,000 tracks are uploaded to the platform every day, and that works out to about one upload every 2 seconds. So what does that mean for our homegrown musicians here in Wisconsin? Can you do this full time? Have you ever recorded a song or album before? What was that like? Join in at 800-642-1234. Pakal Bailey is a hip hop artist and record producer. Marla Frank is a concert promoter and accountant, and they stay with us. Let's go to the phones now with Roger joining us from Burlington. Hi, Roger.
Good morning. I am an owner-operator of a four-piece band that plays regionally in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa, and I started it from scratch. Really, I was a musician, but I knew nothing about the business end of it and hiring people and dealing with equipment issues and things like that. And the other person mentioned taxes. I knew nothing about that. So my comment is basically that it seems to me that 85% of the music business is about the white-collar business side of it, and maybe 15% is actually your craft. It's not a bridge that everyone can jump.
Marla, what do you think of that ratio, 85%?
I can't argue with it, but I can say that keeping track of the business side of it is a huge proportion of being a musician.
And Pakal, Roger was saying there that there's the equipment to think about. There is also the hiring. What do we know about equipment?
I'm sure we know a lot. I think that's, especially for somebody like me who's a music producer, that can be problematic for us because we start focusing more on investing in as much equipment as possible. And that goes back to spending more than you make. You know, what do you actually need is a question that you should ask yourself. For me, it's all about incremental purchases, using what I have. And if I hit some kind of technological ceiling, then I make an informed choice as to whether or not I'm going to invest in an additional piece of equipment. For the most part, it's just a psychological thing. We want to have stuff, and we might not need all that stuff.
And when you talk equipment, what are some of your most important and prized pieces of equipment that you need to do your work?
My most prized piece of equipment is probably ASR-10 because it's this classic digital sampling workstation. But other than, you know, the nostalgia associated with that piece of gear, people like me are successful with a laptop and a MIDI controller.
Hmm. Let's take another call now. Let's go to Josh joining us from Maguanago. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
What's on your mind about this?
Well, I guess a lot, since I'm a live sound engineer, lighting engineer, video engineer in the state of Wisconsin and beyond, for in the mix productions. And I've been doing it solid since 2001. I would say a couple of big things are, make sure you network with other companies that are like-minded. You know, if you got to cover a show or fill in the date for them, so they can do the same for you sometimes. You definitely want to have an accountant, because you can write everything off that you spend. You definitely want to make sure you're good with the tax man. And have fun.
Well, have fun. Josh, thank you so much for ending on that note. Because, Marla, I mean, you're in the weeds on a lot of the numbers, but there is fun in this. Even in your, you know, even as a CPA, you see the fun in the creative.
There truly is. And contrary to popular belief, accountants can be creative. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of ways to be creative within the tax code. But the most important thing to understand is know what the rules are, and then you can be creative and use those rules to your advantage.
Marla, what are some factors that might help artists decide whether it's the right time for touring or it's the right time for the next step, like bigger concerts?
I think a lot of it is driven by money, because so much of it is self-financed now. There aren't other forms like record companies or anyone to finance that for artists, so they have to do it themselves. And it boils down to whether or not they can afford it.
Pakal, what do you think about musicians playing for free or releasing their music for free just to get exposure? Does it pay off in the end?
Yeah, I think that's the new normal. And it's just about adding value to yourself as a musician, to the experience of seeing you perform live, and creating physical merchandise too that complements that experience to the point where you're actually incentivizing a fan to purchase that equipment. I think nowadays, because music is now free for the most part, or at least it's perceived as free, there's nothing free about Spotify per se. It's all monetized. Someone's making money off of it. But for the musicians involved in that equation, the onus is on us to create a much more enticing experience for the fan. That's how we stand out. It's not just music alone. And I don't think it ever was. I think if you're a fan of music, if you were a fan of a act from the 60s, you were a fan of them as people. You were a fan of their energy and their dynamic. But now more than ever, that's a little more overt.
Oh, so like your brand and social media really comes into play here.
Yeah, and social media these days, number one, the beautiful thing about most of it is it's free. And two, you can interact directly with people. In the 60s, you couldn't live stream with the Beatles.
Mm.
But in 2019, the top-selling artist is going live, and you can talk with them, you can interact, you feel like you're brought into their experience, and that makes you a bigger fan.
You're part of a nonprofit called the Urban Community Arts Network, and it's teaching Madison kids about hip-hop and helping them create performances. How did you get involved in this group?
That was... It started with survival, just because we had very few opportunities as hip-hop musicians in Madison. And it just grew. It developed into youth service. It developed into partnerships with public schools within the Madison Metropolitan School District. It developed into professional development opportunities, such as our involvement in Between the Waves this weekend.
So what can the Urban Community Arts Network do to help kids overcome their challenges?
We use hip-hop as pedagogical framework. So we get into the classrooms, we work with the teachers, we work within the curricula that we're presented, and we use hip-hop, which is, you know, the number one music, but then it's also a culture too, and we give cultural context. We give a broad overview, so it's not just, you know, this token gesture of trying to be cool for the kids. It's more authentic. And then we use hip hop to allow them to engage with the subject area. So in the same way that someone might write a sonnet about climate change, for example, is one of the units that we've been working on with Black Hawk Middle School. They end up writing, recording, and performing an original song.
Well, Marla, as we start to have to close here, what resources are available to new or young musicians to help them understand the business and get into it?
There are a lot of online resources, and as previous callers suggested, networking. Learn from those people that have already been down this road, have been through it, and can share their success stories and their failures.
Well, Pakal and Marla, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pakal Bailey is a hip-hop artist who uses the stage name DJ Payne One, and Marla Frank is a CPA and the chief financial officer for Frank Productions, a Madison-based concert promoter. And we should also mention that Frank Productions is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just ahead, two librarians are with us to share some of their favorite books for summer reading. Kids and adults, books for readers of all ages. Stay with us after that, after the news, for that summer reading suggestions. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network.
Don't change your mind, babe. You've got your trigger pulled and you break my heart. So if you...